Call the meeting of the Higher Education and Career Readiness Policy and Finance Committee to order. We now have a quorum, so we're officially in business. First item of business. Do we have minutes? Oh, I'm holding it. We have minutes. Who would like to offer?
Mr. Chair, I move the minutes.
You did that yesterday, too. But that's okay. Christensen offers the amendment, the motion to approve the minutes. Any discussion? Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, minutes have been approved. Thank you very much. Today we are welcoming the folks from Minnesota State. Is that correct? Is that, I want to say Minskew?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
But if Minnesota State is correct? Okay. And we welcome you to be here. You know, I was just going to say that one of the advantages, I mean disadvantages of being here at 3 o'clock is that some people like to take a nap. So we're expecting a high-energy presentation today. And so the pressure is on. Chancellor Rosenstein, I presume you're going to be the first part of the team?
With your permission, we'll refer to our board chair, Michael Beckett.
Okay, all right.
And we will exceed expectations.
Okay, that's great. Mr. Beckett, welcome, and identify yourself for the record, and then proceed.
Thank you, Chair Norris and members. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. I am Michael Vekich, and I serve as Chair of the Board of Trustees of Minnesota State. I'd also like to recognize the gentleman with me at the table. To my right is Trustee Basile Ajou, and, of course, Chancellor Stephen Rosenstone. And in addition, I have several trustees here today I'd like to take a moment to recognize. Trustee Jay Coles, Trustee Don Erlinson, Trustee Cheryl Teffer, and Trustee Alex Cirillo. Thank
you. They're kind of back in the shadows, but that's all right.
Yes.
We saw them wave. So
yes. Chair Norris and members of the committee, I have served on the board twice since 1996, and the reason I keep coming back is that the work of our 30 colleges and 7 universities do every day truly matters to the people in our communities and across Minnesota. In a moment, Trustee Ajou will share with you his most recent story of what Minnesota State means to him. I realize that you will hear today many, I will realize what you will hear today may not be new to some of you, especially if your children or grandchildren have attended one of our campuses. I know a few of you are alumni. So you know who we are and how important we are to your communities and to our state. Minnesota State comprises 30 community colleges and 7 state universities on 54 campuses and 47 communities throughout the state. We are the largest provider of higher education, continuing education, and customized training in the state. And we are the 4th largest higher education system in the nation. We serve nearly 400,000 students that are still in high school, right out of high school, adult learners, and workers and professionals updating their skills or preparing for new careers. Here's how we serve Minnesota. 6 out of 10 students attend our colleges and universities in greater Minnesota. 6 out of 10 of all undergraduate students in Minnesota attend one of our colleges and universities. The other 40% are divided between the private colleges and university and the University of Minnesota. Nearly 9 out of 10 of our students are Minnesotans. And when they graduate, nearly 9 out of 10 graduates get jobs related to their fields, and 8 out of 10 stay in Minnesota. Today we are happy to provide an overview as to who we are, the students we serve, the challenges facing Minnesota, how we meet the state's workforce needs, and what's at risk for our colleges and universities for Minnesota. To do that, we will focus on 4 themes. First, access to higher education. Second, affordability of higher education. Third, the work we do to ensure that communities across Minnesota have the talented workforce they need to be prosperous and finally, the financial accountability of the system. In addition to hearing the board's perspective, the committee will hear about the work that's being done at one of our colleges and from Chancellor Rosenstone and CFO Laura King. Vice Chancellor King will focus on topics the committee requested, such as sources of our revenue, our expenditures, the efficiency and effectiveness of the system, and the financial challenges we face. To that end, we have provided you with the data that includes information down to the campus level. Our colleges and universities are places of hope and opportunity. They provide an opportunity for all Minnesotans to create a better future for themselves, for their family, as well as their communities. The strategic framework is the promise we make. It drives everything that we do. It is the focus of oversight of system performance. The Board of Trustees is a statutorily created entity and also the governing board. As such, its powers and structure are legislatively determined. The board is authorized by the legislature to establish policies that have the effect of law on system constituencies. For example, the Board of Trustees provides oversight and accountability, approves major decisions such as the system budget and large contracts, and oversees an independent audit function. The trustees with whom I serve are thoughtful, respected Minnesotans from a variety of backgrounds. They volunteer their time and talent to keep our colleges and universities strong and to serve Minnesota. On behalf of my fellow trustees, I want to offer my sincere appreciation for the work you do to the communities you serve across the state. And thank you for caring about the students and communities that we serve. And then also thank you for the support you have given our colleges and universities. Now, Mr. Chairman, Trustee Azhu joined the board last year and represents the state's community technical colleges. He will share with you more about his remarkable journey from Africa to Minnesota to the Board of Trustees. And with your permission, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to Trustee Azhu.
Right. Welcome, Mr. Azhu. And if you could make sure you're speaking into one of those mics as clear as possible, it would be helpful. Again, welcome. And if you just identify yourself for the record and then proceed, please.
Chair Nunes, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Basdel Azhu. I represent community college students on the Minnesota State Board of Trustees. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to share my story with you today. And on behalf of all the students who now have a better future because of the incredible work our colleges and universities do, thank you for your support of Minnesota State. I am a first generation immigrant student, born and raised in the Central African country of Cameroon. I grew up very poor. But to be honest, being poor was often the least of my worries. The violence that most people growing up in the United States see only in movies was the kind of violence I endured throughout my childhood. So you could say my life before coming to the United States was unspeakable. I was raised by my grandmother, who wanted me to have the best education, and her greatest wish was for me to have a college degree. But she had no money to send me to school. So for five years ago, I immigrated to this country, to Minnesota, with nothing, no food, no clothing, and no place to stay. I spoke only French and limited English. But I possessed something even more important, a powerful desire to have freedom and the opportunity for much better life. I wanted to be a torchbearer for myself and my family and to make my grandmother proud before she passed away. I knew education was something I could not delay. So I enrolled at North Hennepin Community College to pursue a paralegal degree. But it was not easy. I was in a new country. I was learning a new language. And I was trying to understand a new culture. Every day was a struggle. Going to college full time and working two jobs to have enough money to pay the rent, buy food, and send my daughter to daycare. Through all these challenges, North Hennepin Community College helped me never to lose hope. Faculties and staff provided me with the tools, resources, and encouragement I needed to succeed as a student. They helped me to find my way in a new culture. They helped me to overcome every adversity that could have kept me from crossing the finish line and earning my degree. Through the power of education, Minnesota State has helped me acquire the knowledge, skills, and talents I need to achieve the American dream. I know I have already made my grandmother proud, and I'm now applying an important lesson she taught me. Although she was poor, she gave me something worth more than riches. She taught me that everything that you get in life, you must pay it back to other people. This is what I am doing now, paying back by serving as a trustee of the higher education system that has inspired me to dream beyond my wildest dream in a state where I have chosen as my permanent home as an immigrant to the United States. Chair Nunes, members of the committee, my story may sound extreme, but it's not so different from many of my peers who face challenges that threaten their ability to succeed. The support you provide Minnesota State will widen opportunity for students in all of your communities. First-generation students, adults returning to college, non-traditional students, and low-income students. Every one of whom just need the promise that higher education will be affordable and will have the resources they need to be successful students and highly skilled members of our state's workforce. By investing in our most vulnerable students, you will be providing an opportunity that no one will ever take for granted. I will now like to turn the presentation over to Chancellor Rosa Stone.
We first want to thank you for your story. It's very heartwarming, and that's the kind of story we love to hear. And you did a great job of presenting your story to us. So I have a feeling we'd like to applaud, if that's appropriate. Something we generally don't do here, so again, thank you very much. Chancellor Rosenstone.
Chair Nornes, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Stephen Rosenstone, Chancellor of Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. Also joining us today, Chair Nornes, are presidents from a number of our colleges and universities. I'd like to just recognize them. President Hansen from Anoka-Ramsey Community College and Anoka Tech. President Galswick from Minnesota West and Community and Technical College. Russell Desmond, President of St. Paul College. President Mulford, Pine Technical and Community College. President Kennedy, Minnesota State Community and Technical College. President McDonald, North Hennepin Community College. President Mackey, Northeast Higher Education District. President Charlier, Central Lakes College. President Arthur, Metropolitan State University. President Olson, Monona State University. And President Irving from Hennepin Technical College. Thank you, colleagues, for being here. And I'd also like to recognize the presidents of our two largest faculty unions, President Jim Grabowska from the IFO and President Kevin Lindstrom from MSCF. Thank you as well. Thank you to students, faculty, and staff who are here, as well as those on our 54 campuses around the state who are listening in on the webcast. Before Vice Chancellor King and I provide the system overview and the requested data about our colleges and universities, we thought it might be helpful for the committee to get a sense of how these themes play out on just one of our campuses, and that campus is Hennepin Technical College. And with your permission, Chair Nornes, I would like to turn the presentation over to Hennepin Tech President, Dr. Merle Irving, Jr.,
President Irving will introduce the next speakers who will discuss the critical role that partnerships play in the work of our colleges and universities.
Welcome, Dr. Burbank.
All right. Thank you. Good afternoon. I don't want to disappoint. Got to keep the energy up. Right?
I can feel
all
it.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm President Merle Irving, and, you know, I have the wonderful blessing of serving on behalf of the faculty and students and staff of Hennepin Technical College, but also to serve with colleagues from Minnesota State System of making innovation and change from across this state. I'd like to take the opportunity to tell you who's joining me here today. And right here we have Brad Thorpe, who's faculty of automation robotics at Hennepin Technical College. He also serves on our foundation board. We have one of our students. We have Jordan Falstead. He's a student of automation robotics. And we also have president and CEO of Hartfield Automation and Eden Perry, but also he's president and CEO of our foundation, and helps us to raise $17 to a dollar and over $1 million in leverage equipment and hundreds of thousands of dollars for scholarships for our students every year. So we're very proud and happy that he's here to support us. I'd like to also take this opportunity just to tell you a little bit about the work that the college does every day. We have a 98% placement rate in the field of study. We make a difference. Some of the most economically challenged students come through our doors every day, and they seek an opportunity. But we provide a pathway to prosperity. The average age of our students are 29. They've been a lot of places across this state, but they come to Hennepin Technical College to find a way into their career, and we do it every day. We're very proud about the programs that we have. We have over 50 programs that you can find on our campuses, Brooklyn Park, Eden Prairie, counties that we serve, Hennepin County, Anoka for Brooklyn Park campuses. We've seen an uptick. Scott and Carver counties for Eden Prairie campus need us most because they like to have their citizens stay in their communities, and we provide that opportunity. We provide a pathway. 30% of our students are working 30 hours or more, and we are trying to find every way to close the gaps. Without year-round Pell in the summer, we come up with a scholarship to help those who do not have Pell money to attend college. We're looking at close to 20,000 students, both degree-seeking and non-degree-seeking, on our campuses. 43% of our students are students of color. So we know there's a need. We know there's a desire. And, you know, we commit ourselves every day to keep that pipeline sustained and pathways for our citizens here in Minnesota. I want to take this time to turn it over to our faculty members so you can just get a touch and understanding of what's happening in our classrooms.
Hello, my name is Brad Thorpe. I've been an instructor at Hennepin Technical College for the past 4 years in the Automation Robotics Engineering Technology program. One of my main goals as an instructor there is to provide a high level of educational experience for my students. We do that through state-of-the-art equipment, educational trainers. We do that through industry-level equipment, robotics, and lots of hands-on lab activities. None of these, or many of these opportunities, would not be available to our students without generous donations from our industry partners in our local communities. And through these donations, they not only are donating equipment and supplies, they're also donating industry tours of their facilities. Their employees come in, are guest speakers for our student organization and also our classrooms. And they also provide a numerous amount of experiences in the internship area for our students. We also reach out to the community, to the secondary and educational level. We do a lot with the high schools and junior highs to show them a pathway through high school, through Hennepin Technical College, and on to a successful career. Some of these examples include providing summer camps at our campuses. We bring students onto our campuses and provide hands-on lessons with our instructors, where the high schoolers will spend a couple of hours with our instructors doing different labs on our equipment. We also provide supplies to some of the high schools through donations of surplus that we have, and we work hand-in-hand with providing that pathway for their students. We also work a lot with our industry partners, as mentioned before, with donations, but we also have a very strong tie to our curriculum. So our industry partners do a lot to help us sculpt that curriculum and make sure it's up to standard and it's real time as far as what they're going to be leaving with in skills. In the end, the main goal that we have is to provide support for the workforce in Minnesota in the area of advanced manufacturing and automation with quality graduates. Many of our graduates are obtaining starting salaries at or above four-year graduates, which is a really unique and awesome opportunity out of our program and many of our programs at Hennepin Technical College. I'd now like to turn over the mic to Jordan Polstead, one of our soon-to-be graduates and hopefully getting into the workforce here in the next couple months.
Thank you, Mr. Thorpe, and welcome, Mr. Polstead.
Good afternoon, everyone. Well, I just want to tell you guys some what Hennepin Tech has done for me and what it has done for my life. So after I got out of high school, I didn't really have much of a vision. I was kind of bouncing around from place to place. Couldn't really wanted to go to school, but I convinced myself that it was too expensive, and I didn't want to get into debt. And one day my mom came up to me, and she told me about the automation program at Hennepin Tech. And I'd always been into robotics and been into just mechanical things in general. So she showed me this program at the end of July, and next semester started at the end of August. So I applied, got accepted, and just picked up whatever classes I could. And most of them were full. I just took as many as I could, and I got into the program, didn't really know what to expect. I met Brad. I met one of my other instructors, Jeff. And the second I got there, I just felt like I was in the right place. I could see the end after the first semester. I could see where my life was going. They showed me, like, it was a real job. I could see a real job at the end of it. It wasn't just me bouncing around. I could see we have companies coming in that are presenting in front of our students, pretty much begging them to come and work for them. And that had never happened to me before. I was just minimum wage job to minimum wage job. So to me, it's just, Hennepin Tech has been an opportunity. It's shown me what I want to do with my life. And I don't have to think about that kind of things anymore. And I'm graduating this semester, and I'm very, very excited. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Jordan.
Thank you.
I also would like to reiterate that the program has a starting salary with minimum to no experience of $55,000 a year. It has 100% placement rate out of that program. Another clear indication, and we also thought we have a current student, and we thought, what about having an alumni that's working with our current employer, just to give you a tidbit. And so we have Craig Kiefmeyer. Just to give you a small tidbit about what it was like being at Hennepin Tech and where you are now, what does that mean to you?
Okay. Welcome to the committee, and again, identify yourself for the record,
yes.
Please.
Thank you, Chairman and committee. My name is Craig Kiffmeyer. I reside in Minnetonka. I was a 1988 graduate of the Eden Prairie Hennepin Tech College in fluid power technology, which is in the field of hydraulics and pneumatics. I've been working in that industry since I got out of school. I initially got out of high school. I grew up in Bloomington and didn't really know exactly what I wanted to do. I was good in math and science. Everyone says, oh, go into engineering. And so I got into a community college and then a state school and just really never found my way. So after a couple years of that, I decided to take some interest testing at the Eden Prairie campus and aptitude testing. And fluid power technology was one of the areas that looked like I would be able to put my math and science skills into. And so I took the two-year program, and right away I really enjoyed it. I loved the hands-on effect, you know, the aspect of learning, being able to build things and take things apart and just do things from the ground up and really get a good overall understanding of what the concepts were that we were trying to learn. Taking that to the industry, it was easy to quickly get a job in the industry. There was a lot of employers looking for part-time help, so basically when I got out of school, I had no debt, and I was able to graduate in 2 years. Started in inside sales, the technical inside sales, and was able to apply those skills immediately and was able to work with customers and quickly just help them out. And I had the skills, and I'm like, wow, this is really fun. So working in 1992, I ended up coming to Hartfield Company with Myron, and it was hired as an inside technical salesperson. We quickly started to learn that it was important for us to be able to do manufacturing, do small sub-assemblies, and actually now very complex sub-assemblies for our customers. That was a growing market for us. I ended up running that department for 7 years, and then as Myron, the vision he had, we were going to expand as a distributorship. We were expanding from our area in Minnesota, North, South Dakota, to ended up opening and starting a branch and merging with a company in Des Moines, then opened and then went and moved the family down to Kansas City and then Dallas to open up new branch locations, all the while basically working in inside from the inside operations side and also the technical sales side. Today I'm a minority owner in the company, and I've been working there 24 years and had a great experience, and led me down a path that I would never have guessed. And as Jordan was saying, I know that his future is bright because I know the automation aspect of technology today is thriving, and there's a huge need in the market to help companies come alongside companies as a distributor to help them find the new innovations and new technologies that they'll need to make better products for the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kiffmeyer. Dr. Irving?
Yes, I appreciate that. Thank you so much. One of the other things that's wonderful about the college is that we have over 200 industry partners that we work with annually that helps us to advise in our curriculum and development, but also participates actively with our foundation. And so I'd like to take this opportunity to introduce the president and CEO, Myron Mosier of Hartfield Automation. You ready?
Yeah.
All right. To take over and tell us a little bit about your commitment to the college, why it's so important, how you've continued to transform our lives, our system, and the difference that we make.
Welcome, Mr. Mosier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Myron Mosier. I'm chairman and CEO of Hartfield Automation. And by the way, Kiffy's a rock star, just so you know. Hartfield Automation is an automation, motion control, and robotics company headquartered in Eden Prairie. We've been there for almost 59 years. We supported Hennepin Tech by hiring graduates and giving donations of cash and gifts in kind over the last 25 years, totaling over hundreds of thousands of dollars. I joined Hartfield October 1st, 1990 as a sales engineer and eventually bought the company from the founder at the end of 99. And since 1990, when I joined, we've grown by a factor of over 25 times in the last 26 years. And last year, we just topped the $100 million mark for the first time, so we're pretty excited about that. We have over 200 employees, and of them, 61 of them are Minnesota College educated, and that includes everything from master's to two-year degrees. 43 of those are Tech College graduates, and 19 of those came from Hennepin Tech College. Excuse me. Our Minnesota educated employees have fueled our incredible growth. So since 1990, we've bought four companies, we've started four more, we sold one, and we now have seven offices covering 16 states. We also have two light manufacturing assembly facilities that Kiffy was talking about, and we're starting a third one. I'm passionate about technical colleges because I'm a graduate of one. Minnesota West, where's the Minnesota West guy? Here we go. Sorry, Merle. I was a junior in high school when I knew what I wanted to do, and I just took the shortest path to it. But according to studies released by Deloitte and the Metropolitan Council and others, we face a startling workforce shortage in the coming years, particularly in manufacturing and associated trades. I'm sure that's not news to anyone in the room. But that's exactly what the technical colleges produce. Hennepin Tech, as Dr. Irving says, has a stellar placement rate of around 98%. When you graduate, if you can fog a mirror, you got a job. In fact, there's probably more than one job waiting for you. There are some programs that have multiple jobs for every student that graduates. But the dirty little secret is the persistent rates in technical colleges can be somewhere around 50% or worse. And that means the students that finish first year, half of them or more don't come back for second year. Now, some of those are happy stories. They get a job right away. But a percentage of that is due to lack of funds. And I can tell you, as president of the foundation, I sign off on crisis grants many times per week, sometimes daily. And these are students that, single mothers, that their car broke down and now they can't pay the rent. And they want to stay. They want to finish their education. They'll do whatever they have to. Many of them, as Merle mentioned, are working multiple jobs. So I'm also the president of the Hennepin Tech Foundation Board, which raises money for scholarships and grants for students of Hennepin Tech. And to date, we have raised over $10 million total since inception in 1999. So we're not just sitting here asking for a handout. We have been and are more than willing to continue to help the college raise money. We think it's that important. So I would ask you to please help us invest more in Hennepin Tech, invest more in the technical colleges, and in doing so, you're helping hardworking students build their dream, and you're strengthening our local and state economies. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Moser.
All right.
Back to you.
Yes. Urban. Yeah, so, I'd like to, first of all, thank you, Myron. It was excellent. And, I'd like to conclude by thanking everyone for taking the opportunity to listen to us, and also to thank my colleagues, my presidential colleagues, and system colleagues that's come here from all over the state to help and endorse our efforts, and to also to thank our Board of Trustees and members of the board that are here as well that are supporting us. Now, with your permission, I would like to turn the presentation back over to Chancellor Rosenstone and also Vice Chancellor King, if that's okay.
That is fine.
Thank you.
Thank you all for your presentation. Chancellor Rosenstone, again.
Thank you, Member. Welcome again. Yeah. What you've just heard from Hennepin Technical College paints, I think, a pretty vivid picture of what our colleges and universities mean to people and communities across Minnesota and how our colleges and universities serve students and communities. What's happening at Hennepin Tech is happening on 54 campuses around the state of Minnesota every single day of the year. And fundamentally, this story is about access, it's about affordability, and it's about talent. We provide access to education throughout the state. Our 37 colleges and universities are in 47 communities across Minnesota because that's where our students live. That's where their families live. That's where they work. And that's where our business partners reside. As Chair Vekic mentioned at the outset, nearly 6 out of 10 of all undergraduates in the state of Minnesota are enrolled in one of our colleges and universities. We're the big green chunk to the right there. And the remainder is split just about evenly between the University of Minnesota, the privates, and the for-profits. We protect affordability by keeping tuition affordable. Obviously, we cannot serve students if they can't afford to attend or if they're saddled with mountains of debt. In a few minutes, Vice Chancellor King will provide you a lot more detail about that. But for the moment, our colleges and universities are the lowest cost, highest value option in the state of Minnesota. The green bars on that chart represent the height, the higher the tuition and fees. All the green bars are our colleges and universities. And the red bars are the University of Minnesota, the privates, and the for-profits. We're about half the cost of the University of Minnesota and about one-fifth the cost of the privates. But more importantly, who we serve, is fundamentally different from other providers of higher education. Roughly 400,000 students, but 260,000 of those students are in degree-seeking programs. Fully 43,400 are students of color, or American Indian students. 48,500 first generation, over 84,000 students from families of very modest or low income, and over 10,000 veterans and active duty service personnel in every single one of these categories. Our colleges and universities serve more students than all of Minnesota's other higher education providers combined. We are the place of hope and opportunity. With open enrollment, anyone with a high school diploma or a GED has an opportunity to create a better future for themselves, for their families, and their communities. You heard from Trustee Aju. He testified, but he also said his story is not unique. On the screen is Jean David Charles, a civil engineering major at Indra Hills Community College, a survivor of the 2010 earthquake in Haiti, and now the first in his college, first in his family, rather, to attend college. But beyond the 260,000 students in degree-seeking programs, we are also the state's largest provider of customized training and continuing education, where we partner with companies across the state to help more than 136,000 Minnesota employees to get the advanced training they need to stay at the leading edge of their professions. Our students are different, and our students have different needs. Open enrollment means that our students face academic challenges. They face financial challenges. They face family challenges. They're working two or more jobs. Their average age is 25. Finances, jobs, academic challenges, family responsibilities means that many of them have to go part-time, and indeed, half of our students do so. And our colleges and universities work diligently to meet the special needs of our unique students. That means we have to provide not only academic advisors and career counselors, but mental health counselors and financial aid counselors to help students find ways to finance their education. We also have to help our students connect with community social service agencies, because some of them are hungry and some of them are homeless, and there are other pressing family needs that need to be met. Our strategy, and I would say our state's strategy, has always been to help all students succeed, even those that need a little extra help, and even those that need a little extra time to do so. Now, for our students, finishing a degree in a specified time frame is not that simple. And it's not that simple for those that face academic challenges, family challenges, and financial challenges. And I know that some higher education colleagues like to point to the comparative time to completion rates, and there's no question all of us have to be focused. All of us have to be focused on student success. But again, Minnesota State is our state's open access option. You might have seen this past weekend in an article that appeared in the Pioneer Press pointing out where Minnesota's most financially stressed students are attending college. Compared to many other colleges in the state, you know, we just don't have many wealthy students. Fully 46% of our students, nearly half, are coming from the poorest 60% of our state's population. Put differently, financial resources and preparedness drive time to completion, and our students need and take a little more time to finish. And I think, as was pointed out by President Irving, sometimes there's other causes for students leaving programs, and they'll be pulled out by great jobs. And many of our programs, employers are hovering as students begin the program, and as soon as they get to a certain juncture in the program and are ready to go, they pull them right out. We don't consider that a failure. I assure you, our students do not consider that a failure, and businesses around the state who get those employees and can keep growing their firms do not consider that a failure either. Our colleges and universities help students develop the talent they need to better their lives and to bring that know-how to businesses and communities across the state. As Chair Vekic mentioned in his opening remarks, 9 out of 10 of our students are Minnesotans. 8 out of our 10 graduates stay right here in Minnesota, and 9 out of 10 in our technical fields, nearly 10 out of 10, get jobs in their field of study. We are serving precisely the students who need to get the education to make them the talent that businesses and industry across Minnesota desperately need to succeed. And yet, as you well know, and as Myron pointed out to us, Minnesota is facing a looming talent crisis. There is no other state in the nation that needs a better educated workforce than Minnesota. By 2020, which is in our business like the day after tomorrow, fully 74% of all the jobs in Minnesota will require some post-secondary education. Only half of those jobs will require a baccalaureate degree or higher, and the other half certificates or associate degrees. The most precious resource affecting our ability to recruit, retain, and grow businesses across the state of Minnesota is our human capital. And the economic vitality and competitiveness of communities across Minnesota hinges more than ever before on our ability to deliver the human capital needed for the jobs that need to be done. And we know that this shortage of talent that we're facing today threatens to grow into literally a talent crisis if we don't do some things differently. At the same time that the need for a well-educated workforce has been growing, there are fewer and fewer Minnesotans available to fill those jobs. Over the next 15 years, fully 1.3 million Minnesotans, the baby boomers, will retire. There's been a dip, as you know, in the number of high school graduates in our state, meaning there's a dip in the number of people going into higher ed. And our population, the demographer tells us, is slowing to the slowest growth rate in its history. And how about the population growth that's going to occur? Fully 70% of that growth statewide over the next 25 years is going to be among people of color. Communities of color are the workforce of the future in Minnesota, yet the people for whom the economic vitality of our state critically depends are increasingly less prepared with the education they need for the jobs of the future. At a time of baby boom retirements and slowing population growth, simply put, Minnesota cannot afford to leave anyone behind. And that's who we serve. That's why we are so critical to Minnesota's future. And that's where the 40,000 graduates who come out of our colleges and universities each year play an absolutely critical role. The last point I want to make before turning it over to Vice Chancellor King is this. What does it really mean for us to be focused on the workforce needs of Minnesota? And let me tell you, it's a whole lot more than just turning out some graduates. Meeting Minnesota's workforce needs means playing a leadership role in partnership with business and industry. It means listening carefully to what the needs of business and industry are, as I did from the first year I was on the job, 58 listening sessions around the state, meeting with businesses in every sector, every region of the state, going with our deans and with our presidents to figure out what changes do we need to make in our courses, what new courses do we need, what programs need to be invented, what programs need to be changed or reduced. Meeting Minnesota's workforce needs means playing a leadership role in building the information systems like real-time talent that provide the data that students need to understand the skills they need, the programs that are in high demand, that our academic deans and faculty need to figure out exactly what talent needs to be there coming out of those programs to assure that our programs are aligned with the talent needs of our state. Meeting Minnesota's workforce needs means really working closely with businesses, like we heard in the Hennepin Tech example, where businesses sit on advisory committees to advise the faculty and program directors about the content of those programs to make sure that the graduates have the specific skills and capabilities needed to meet the needs of our industry partners. And finally, meeting Minnesota's workforce needs means that our presidents actually participate on regional economic development councils, as they do around the state, are actively engaged with the chambers of commerce around the state, so they are deeply embedded in partnerships to help build the economic vitality of those communities. This is serious work, work that is at the very core of what we do every single day. It's core to our mission, and I would submit it's core to the state of Minnesota. That's what it means to be focused on meeting the workforce needs of Minnesota. This has been our priority, and this is the priority work of our colleges and universities who are in your community. And again, it's simply not enough to turn out some graduates. It's about turning out the right number of graduates in the right places with the right knowledge and skills, graduates who can fill the jobs that need to be done today and in the future. The success of this work is in the 40,000 students we graduate every year. Not just graduates, but graduates ready to meet the specific workforce needs of our state. and graduates, by the way, who stay in Minnesota. Graduates who are part of the talent solution to the challenges that Minnesota is facing. As this slide shows, every sector of human endeavor in Minnesota depends heavily on our graduates. Because our colleges and universities together as a system offer the full range of programs needed to produce those graduates. You know our graduates. They are the men and women you encounter every single day in your communities, no matter where you live in the state of Minnesota. Our graduates are managing cities. They're leading our businesses. They're fixing our cars. They're building our roads and homes. They're defending our networks from attack. They're teaching our children. They care for us when we are sick. They staff the labs that lead to innovation. They keep our factories humming. They grow our food. And our graduates are the first responders who are there at life's most frightening moments. Minnesota State College and University graduates are the talent that Minnesota's counting on. They are the future prosperity of your community and our state. And with that, Chair Nornes, members of the committee, with your permission, I'd like to turn the presentation over to our CFO, Vice Chancellor Laura King.
Thank you, Chancellor. I just want to tell the members that I think we'll hold all questions until they're all done. So, Ms. King, you're standing between questions and your
thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good afternoon, everyone. I'll have to think about which way to push that.
Take your time.
Thank you very much, and thank you to the Chancellor. I'm delighted to be here with you today to open the 2017 legislative session with an overview. For some of you, this might not be new information, but for others, I'm hoping that you'll hear something today that's of interest to you. Each of our colleges and universities is governed by the board's expectation of financial stewardship and accountability. The campus CFOs partner with their presidents, with their campus leadership, and with folks in the system office to build a stable, predictable financial environment. Today I will introduce you to what we think of as a pretty simple operation. I'll outline for you where our revenues come from, how we spend them, describe our employee base, illustrate our nationally recognized efficiency, and say a bit about the stress that our colleges and universities are under. At your place, I think I see some of you leafing through what is artfully titled the data book. We put this together for you in response to some staff interest in having more extensive information. You'll see multi-year data here, system level, school level, slicing the data in as many ways as we could think of to respond to your interests. And it includes information about our allocation framework, which I'll talk about here in just a moment, how we distribute funds to campuses, tuition and fee trends, student debt trends, administrative costs, and some details on campus budgets.
Well, thank you for that. It's very thorough.
Certainly. And we're always happy to add to it, to expand on anything if you see something you're interested in pursuing. It's already approaching 150 pages, so get your bifocals out and a straight ruler because it's a lot of pretty detailed information. I would like to provide some background information and then some system-level information in the next few slides, and then talk a bit about the financial pressures that our colleges, our universities are under. As you heard the chair mention, Minnesota State is the fourth largest system in the country on a headcount basis. We have progressed since the merger from three accounting systems and 42 payroll systems to one accounting and payroll system with strong financial controls and data reliability. We have built and operate the only unified IT enterprise platform in the country. Other states have either already converted to a purchase package or are now in the process of doing that. We are still running on a very large legacy system, which you'll hear more about when we're back with you on the budget request. We recently completed a credit review from Standard & Poor's and Moody's as part of our recent revenue fund sale. and we find again to be recognized for strong governance, strong financial management, and strong strategic planning and financial controls, and had our rating affirmed for the upcoming sale. We have modeled many of our financial and debt management policies after those that are in place here at the state of Minnesota, which for many years carried a AAA credit rating and was a good resource for us to look at. The board and the chancellor have built a very robust presidential accountability system, strategic and metric-based, as well as cabinet oversight, and we all have goals and find ourselves measured annually, just before summer vacation, which is a great way to finish the year. Finally, all of our colleges and universities are accredited by the Higher Learning Commission, which is the regional accrediting entity for this part of the country. This review examines academic, student success, and financial management at each of our colleges and universities. I mentioned the data book that you find at your place at 147 pages. You'll find aggregate system information, campus-by-campus specific information, and multi-year trend data for the topics that are shown on the slide. Everything from academic data to student data, enrollment data, human resources data, information about our physical plant, financial data, and technology data. We want to be responsive and transparent and respond to any member interest, so please stay in touch with us, and if there's something you'd like us to expand on, we'd be happy to do that. We'll add to this book as we go along this session, and as soon as we have a chance to catch up, we'll get it posted on our website. We don't quite have that accomplished. To switch gears here just a bit and talk about the systems budget, the systems total budget in fiscal 17 was $1.9 billion, with $1.56 billion of that in the so-called general fund, which is where we carry all of our core instruction and administration and support and physical plant activities. The other funds on this side, on this slide, include things like student activities, parking ramps, wellness centers, residence halls, so-called auxiliary activities. The system's operating budget was essentially flat from fiscal 16 to fiscal 17, increasing by 0.3%. State support did not increase from 2016 to 17. Tuition revenue declined, both because of enrollment declines and the rate freeze at the university and the 1% rate decline at the colleges. Since 2007, in inflation-adjusted terms, the system's total expenses have changed by 0.5% per year. Since 2011, expenses have declined in constant dollars compared to 2017. In 2011, in unadjusted dollars, the system's budget was $1.8 billion, and in 2016, you'll see our total expenses were $1.8 billion. So we have, in real nominal dollars, unadjusted for inflation, just straight off the books, we've had an increase in our operating budget in the last 5 years of less than 0.5%. The fiscal year 17 general fund operating budget includes 1.5 of that $1.9 billion that I mentioned. General fund revenues in fiscal 17 are projected to grow slightly by $8 million, or 0.5%. The tuition rate freeze, rate reduction, combined with enrollment declines, account for this loss of tuition revenue. General fund expenses, you can see here, are projected to grow by $13 million, or about 1%, from fiscal 16 to fiscal 17. And you can see that compensation increases there are showing a net increase of $13 million. We otherwise had $37 million in absolute budget reductions so that we could close the outlook with a balanced budget for fiscal 17. Had we simply grown the compensation line in keeping with the changes in wage rates and fringe benefit costs, that compensation and other operating cost line would have gone up by $50 million. Minnesota State is really a simple operation. 92% of our general fund revenue comes either from students or from the state. 75% of our expenses pay for employees, 25% for other operating costs. So very straightforward on the revenue side and on the expense side. And that really, I think, explains why you hear us talking with you every year about the relationship that you see here on this graph. We came back to you 2 years ago and asked for your help in moving the state's investment back toward its historic funding commitment. The central tenet of our concern then and now is the role of the state's investment versus the role of student tuition. As the state dramatically reduced its support for higher education, students have borne a higher and higher share of those costs, even though our total spending is flat. And that's been a difficult message to communicate in the general media, because they see tuition increases and they think revenue's going up, when in fact we're just substituting what had been historic state support for tuition. In 2002, the state provided 66% of the cost of a student's education. We hit a low of 39% in 2013, and with your help these past years, the state's share has increased to 47%. Full support of our request would move the state's support to 51%, so certainly movement in the right direction. The approach in our request enables us to hold down the cost of tuition while continuing to protect access to high-quality, high-value education in communities across the state for programs that are essential to the value we bring to Minnesota's health. Over the past two biennia, the governor and the legislature have provided us with $255 million in new resources. These funds have come in exchange for a tuition freeze and have not been sufficient to replace lost tuition dollars. Our campuses are certainly under pressure, and we'll walk through those concerns. Just as one more comment on this slide, were you to be in a position to get us back to the one-third, two-thirds relationship by the end of fiscal 19, it would require about $500 million in additional state investment this biennium. That's how far away we've gotten from the historical relationship. Tuition rates have certainly been changing over this same period. The increases have slowed considerably over the past 10 years, and you can see in the most recent years that tuition rates have been held constant. During the 2013 legislative session, increased state funding was directed to tuition relief, and tuition rates were frozen at 2013 levels in both 2013 and 2014, and 2015 for all undergraduate college and university students. College tuition remained frozen in 2016, while university rates increased modestly, and then in fiscal 17, tuition at the universities was again frozen, and it declined 1% at the colleges. So since 2013, university tuition has increased once, and college tuition has increased not at all. I also have for you information here about fees. When we add mandatory student fees to this narrative, what you see here is fee increases that have averaged about $18 per student annually in total, year over year, from 06 to 17. These would include things where if the campus offers the service and requires the fee, the student pays it. You'll see in the data book a very detailed table of student fees, and what you'll notice is that all the campuses don't charge the same fees. So I don't have for you a package of identical fees that everyone pays. But if they charge it on the campus as a mandatory fee, then I captured it in the $18 here that we talked about. It includes student life, technology, per-credit parking charges, wellness centers. If the campus has a student union, they would pay a student union fee. And, of course, all the campuses charge the student life fee and the student activity, student association fee. So the combination of tuition and fee increases are shown here on this chart. And you can see on an average basis over this whole period, from 14 to 17, the total cost increase has been less than half of 1% per year. We are also primarily in the business of teaching undergraduates. Consequently, 90% of our tuition revenue comes from undergraduate tuition. Total tuition revenue in 2016 was $803 million. And you can see on this graphic much smaller revenue streams from customized training and continuing ed activities, graduate students, and other. It's important, we believe, to recognize the unique advantage of our system. We, as we show on this graphic here, we offer significantly lower debt consequences for graduates at our colleges. $16,000 is the average for those who graduate with debt versus $25,000 for bachelor's degrees. And our debt levels are down 2 to 3% in our reporting from last year. The debt of our associate graduates is nearly $10,000 lower than the debt of associate graduates at private and for-profit colleges, and a large percentage of our students graduate with no debt at all, 26% to 46%, depending upon the academic credential received. Our graduates get jobs in their fields more than 80% of the time, as the Chancellor mentioned, often before they finish their studies. And as we heard from President Irving, the program that you heard about today has a 100% placement rate and a starting salary day one on average of $55,000. So very attractive and very affordable. To change gears here a bit to the allocation formula, once we finish the legislative process and the biennial budget is established, we then come back to our board table, and the board, through its approved allocation formula, distributes the funds to the campuses. This support is distributed annually through a formula that was developed by work groups of campus staff, both finance and academic staff. It's reviewed annually by the presidents and reviewed by the board. At the center of the formula is the production of something we call an instructional cost study, and I know some of your staff have looked at it over the years. This is a report that calculates the cost of instruction on a per FYE basis at every level of instruction for every program. So our chief academic officers and CFOs can sit down and look at data that compares what they're spending per student with what their colleagues across the system are spending for the same program. Schools in the formula compete on the basis of cost efficiency and for similar programs. So the formula recognizes a lower cost for liberal arts instruction and a higher cost for technical educational instruction. It also, the formula rewards efficient management. And you have information in your data book that describes at some length how the formula runs its work. The board reviews this annually, and annual allocations are approved as part of the annual budget process. I mentioned earlier that a substantial portion of our cost structure is related to employees, and what you see here is the 75% I mentioned of our all-funds budget. And then we've cut it up so that you can see what portion of those dollars support instructional faculty, what portion support service and support classified employees, professionals, managers, and administrators, et cetera. The largest increase in these employee classes in recent years has been in the professional group, and when you get into the data book, you'll see that. That's where our campus IT staff are showing up in the data. Remembering that we have an overall flat budget and stable spending on instruction as a percentage of the budget, if IT staff are growing, then that means staff somewhere else is shrinking. And that's absolutely the case. We've had reductions in our AFSCME classified employee groups over the last several years as schools have balanced their budgets in a flat revenue environment with a trade-off on demands in employee types. We have three faculty groups, the IFO, the faculty for the state universities, MSCF, which is the faculty group for the colleges, and MSUAAF, which is the faculty group for the university advisory class. We also have six bargaining groups, including AFSCME, MAPE, MMA, the engineers, the nurses, and health treatment professionals. And these groups are all negotiated by MMB through the executive branch. And then we have three so-called plans, which is where we put otherwise unrepresented employees. And that includes administrators, commissioner plan members, and managerial plan members. You can see here the distribution of those employees by employee role. And I just would make one observation, which is that the number of administrators you see here across the system has declined by nearly 10% in the last 5 years. And has hovered between 2.5% and 3% as long as the organization's been in place. This is where we count things like presidents, chief academic officers, chief human resource officers, deans, the leadership of the campuses, as well as folks in the system office. I believe the chancellor might have mentioned this earlier. Between 2007 and 2016, the number of employees system-wide has decreased 6.8%, while the number of employees of color has increased 27%. There has been a very directed effort on behalf of the part of the board and the chancellor and the leadership council to recruit, train, and help be successful students of employees of color all across the system. This is a commitment of ours that is in concert with presidential expectations around performance, and we're seeing the results of that with the strategies that have been put in place over the last 5 years in our recruitment in the last several years. Go forward. Oh, sorry. I got behind. I mentioned the reduction in administrators in a few slides ago. One of the ways we benchmark ourselves is to look at similar systems of higher education, public systems of higher education across the country, and measure what we spend on institutional support compared to those systems. Institutional support is where we capture things like the president's office, the chancellor's office, the administrators that I just mentioned earlier. And what we find is that when we line ourselves up with other systems, other state systems across the country, we're 33rd out of 50 in institutional spending per FYE. And this is, of course, as the chancellor likes to say, a list that you want to be on the bottom of, not on the top of. We have fluctuated between 35% and 45% on this list over the last 15 years as we've been measuring it. It's pretty volatile year to year, depending upon enrollment trends. But at the moment, we're running 11% below the national average in institutional spending compared to similar systems, and we're below all of the contiguous states. Our colleges and universities have worked very aggressively to manage administrative costs. For instance, we have system-wide purchasing programs that have saved campuses approximately $2.5 million a year just in the last 2 years, and we expect they'll save a total of $14 million with the years, the 3 years ahead of us. Our HR community is working to build shared payroll processing centers at 4 regional offices across the state, which will improve services certainly, and as importantly for those of us that talk to auditors, lower the error rates. The board continues to examine campus alignment opportunities. We now have 30 presidents versus 42 at the time of the merger. And we have presidents and their leadership teams responsible for facilities in 5, 6, 7, or 8 towns across their region. We also pay careful attention to the size of the system office, and you'll see that administrative costs in the system office have gone down substantially in the last 10 years. Our share of the state appropriation, which is how we finance operations, is specified in law, and presently we're consuming about 2.1% of the system's general fund revenue to pay for operations in support of the board and campus leadership. The system office really has been built and is dedicated to campus services. We were 3 system offices, of course, at the time of the merger, and that office's work was merged and has been substantially reorganized since that time. 75% of the activities in the system office provide services to campuses like the technology platform, financial reporting, capital program planning and construction administration, and student services. Since 2010, the system office staffing level has declined by nearly 15%, a reduction of about 60 FTE. All the divisions have reduced FTE, most notably Academic and Student Affairs and the Information Technology Group. The work of this office has been examined three times since 1995, most recently in a report issued by the Office of the Legislative Auditor. In that most recent report, which was released in December of 2009, the auditors recommended a number of modifications for implementation in the system office, and I will tell you today all of them either have been implemented or were mid-flight in implementing them. For instance, expansion of a multi-campus service delivery for administrative services. As the auditors recommended, we're now underway with the HR effort. Increasing project management and planning for capital projects, we have that in place. Increasing strategic IT planning, as well as increased IT assistance to campuses. While the auditors recommended that, their recommendation doesn't often come with resources attached, so that has been a work effort for us. They also recommended that we improve enterprise emergency management, safety, and risk management, and we have done that. And finally, they recommended increasing enterprise functionality for student-facing business and student services, like registration, single bill, single payment, etc. And that's what you'll hear about when we talk about the IT Next Gen project in the days ahead. I haven't said much about the financial pressure facing our colleges and universities. I'm trying to save something for our operating budget presentation, but I did want to leave you with a slide that illustrates what has happened over these past 20 years. This is not a Minnesota state slide. This is a state of Minnesota slide, by which I mean it illustrates what's happened to the state of Minnesota's investment in public higher education and the lag that has developed in comparison to the national average. In 1995, Minnesota's per FYE funding for public higher education was 5% higher than the national average. 10 years later, in 2005, Minnesota's spending per FYE on an inflation-adjusted basis lagged the national average by 9%. And by 2015, the most recent year that national data is available, Minnesota lags the national average by 14%. Between 1995 and 2015, Minnesota's investment in higher education has declined at twice the national average, by 29% versus 14%. So think of that as you think about the Chancellor's remarks concerning the workforce of the future and the pressures that are coming to Minnesota in the educational space. Over the past 5 years, our colleges and universities have reallocated a substantial portion of their resources in order to balance the budget. Revenues have increased on average about 2% a year, while our compensation costs have increased between 4 and 5% a year. And again, you'll see some significant detail about that in the data book. In fiscal 2017, with declining enrollment and flat state support, these pressures led to large budget cuts and reallocations. Our colleges and universities really have a tough hand. Both revenues and expenses are strongly influenced by others and highly unpredictable. Regulatory and compliance costs increase every year, as does a desire for stronger student services and campus life programs. One of the tools that they use is what we call reallocation, which really is, in the ordinary course of business, moving resources from lower priorities to higher priorities. Unfortunately, in the last couple of years, it also has required us to move resources from priorities to the cutting room floor. In just the past 5 years, we have reallocated $181 million, and $114 million of that was an absolute budget cut. These cuts have eliminated jobs, closed programs, and slowed technology and equipment replacement. The data book includes our 2016 reallocation report, and you can see in detail the consequences of these efforts. In 2016 alone, we had over 200 layoffs that resulted from the reallocation effort. Our colleges and universities are under tremendous financial pressure, and we're concerned that this pressure cannot sustain our operations and ensure the quality and student services that we know we need to deliver for the students to be successful. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to, if I might, turn back to the Chancellor, and we'll close.
Chancellor.
Chair Narnas, members of the committee, we have one last slide, which I must say I objected to. I fought hard to get this slide excluded, and clearly you have a sense of the authority and power I have within the organization. We're critical to communities across the state of Minnesota. We're critical to the communities that each of you live in. We're critical to your businesses. We're critical to the people in that community. And we're absolutely critical to the future economic prosperity of your community and the future economic prosperity of our state. You know, there's no silver bullet for pulling people out of poverty. But the closest thing we have to it is a great education that prepares them for a great job. And that's what our focus is all about in Minnesota State. We're the solution to the looming talent crisis that Minnesota is going to confront. And it's work that we're not suddenly discovering we need to do, but work that's been at the heart and soul of what our colleges and universities have been doing in partnership with business and industry for years. We're facing some risks. And when we reconvene in a couple weeks at the call of the chair to begin to discuss the budget request for this biennium, we will be providing much greater detail about the risks that we face and the challenges that our campuses are facing and what that does to meeting the needs of your community and the needs of the state of Minnesota and pulling out of poverty those that are the workforce of the future. And you'll get a hint of that if you go through the data book that Vice Chancellor King made reference to. I'll say our colleges and universities are also very diligent about doing what we need to continue to do to continue to push even harder on reducing costs and being creative in how it is we need to grow revenues. But if we want to reduce the economic and racial disparities in our state, and if we want to bring forward everybody who has to be brought forward to meet the workforce challenges the state of Minnesota is facing, we cannot do this alone. We have to do it in partnership with the legislature and the governor to protect affordability, to protect access, and to make sure we're turning out the talent that your community needs and that the state of Minnesota needs. With that, Chair Narnas, we'll stop. We do look forward to the discussion, look forward to your questions, and as Vice Chancellor King suggested, if they require us providing additional detail beyond what's in the data book, we look forward to providing that detail to you as well. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Chancellor. Very good presentation. Thanks to all the people that were up here with you. And we do have a few questions, beginning with Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, thank you for a wonderful presentation and the data book. I'm really, really impressed with all the information you provided. This is a question for Chancellor Rosenstone. What is your educational background, your undergraduate major, graduate fields of study?
Chair Narnas, Representative Schultz, I am a recovering political scientist.
Well, that's good to know that we see a lot of great things from students who major in the liberal arts, and for you to bring a wonderful presentation to us and data and to hire the people you've hired to come here today to present. So I think I knew that you were liberal arts, and I just wanted to point to the value of liberal arts degrees in addition to the STEM fields. And another question, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, I'm really interested in learning more about your formula on how you distribute funds on your tuition revenue across campuses. So if you guys are willing to share that in more detail later, you don't have to tell me now. I want to ask Chancellor Rosenstone, since you were formerly at the University of Minnesota, I'm wondering your opinion on whether that same allocation formula could work in the University of Minnesota system.
Chancellor.
Chair Narnas, Representative Schultz, I see sharks in these waters. Yeah. First and foremost, all tuition revenue stays on our campuses.
none of it is moved off the campuses. It's all there to support the academic endeavors that are there programmatically for our students. A fundamental difference, and we had a chance to chat only briefly about this last week, between how state funds are allocated in Minnesota state system as opposed to the University of Minnesota, is that it's formula-driven. It's not a decision in the Wells Fargo building, a decision by the chancellor. It's not what things I happen to be interested in or who's my friend today. It's driven by the cost that campuses are trying to meet to serve students given the portfolio programs they have, with some incentives there for efficiency in the way they deliver those programs. That means that my relationship with presidents is not a political relationship. It's how we can help you achieve what you're trying to achieve. And it's predictable. A CFO can sit there and look out a year and make some assumptions about what's going to happen to enrollments and state support and be able to make some predictions. And there's some lag, if you will, in the pace at which things move, so it's not abrupt, where people have adjustments that are very difficult to make given that there's lots of lives, both of employees and students involved. And so all the details of the rules about how that allocation framework works is in the book. We have the world's expert on the allocation framework sitting to my right, and I'm sure we'd be happy to respond to what's there. And I will leave it to other people far wiser than I to suggest whether or not that is a method that other institutions should use. Did I dodge that one adequately, do you think, Chair Norris?
Mr. Chair, I think that's a good pivot. So I'm wondering, so the state allocation is what you allocate.
Exactly.
With the formula, that doesn't change very much. People know going into it what the formula is when they make their request and put together their priorities. How much do you retain of state funding to advance your priorities? How much of that state funding is retained system-wise at the system level?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schultz, you saw on one of the slides about 12% does not get put into what we talk about as the top of the funnel, which is the allocation framework. And there's details in the data book. That 12% does things like pays the system-wide debt service bill. It pays the attorney general bill. It pays the system-wide auditor bill. It pays for a portion of the IT enterprise platform. And it supports the system office operations. That's all detailed in the data book. The board establishes what that split is between one funnel and the other funnel every year, and the presidents are engaged as well in a discussion about allocating state resources.
Chair Nornis, if I might, with your permission, Councilor. Add, Representative Schultz, there is not $30, $40 million held back that Steve Rosenstone gets to decide where it's going. We put every penny we can onto our campuses and trust our presidents through the consultative processes on their campuses to decide how best to allocate those funds.
I just have one last question, really. When you present this again, or maybe in the next few weeks you could redo some of these slides, could you show per full-time equivalent for full-year equivalent student rather than headcounts in many of these slides? And could you also present the allocation to the campuses by per FTE FYE student so I can see it per student?
Mr. Chairperson Schultz, we'll have to do a little thinking on that. And in our lexicon, a full year equivalent student is a full year student. So they are synonymous to us. Everything you see there expressed as a full-time equivalent student is a year's worth of student, 30 credits. So I think you've got it there already. As far as expressing the results of the allocation framework on a FYE basis, the end result, we could do that, but I would just suggest to you it's not very meaningful. So we might want to spend some time talking about it.
Yeah, it's easier for me to compare that with the University of Minnesota system when I'm thinking about how much we're allocating
to
the two different systems. That's why it would be helpful for me. I understand it wouldn't be helpful for you in terms of your allocation.
Well, sort of in just big stroke numbers, we're about $600 million a year in state appropriation on 135,000 FYE, and the university, I think, is similarly about $600 million on 67,000 FYE. But the process doesn't work on a FYE basis. So
Thank you for that. And you do have a lot of slides by headcount, so for me it would be better if it was FYE. Thanks.
We'll talk about what you'd like, particularly.
Representative Haley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the presentation. I have some, there may be some questions woven in here, but more comments and reflections, I guess, and maybe a few challenges. First of all, my mother was a teacher when I was young, started an egg banking program in Red Wing, what we used to call the tech college. And my dad's a graduate of Winona State, and my son is currently in a technical program. So
you're in very deep.
I support the system, and I wholeheartedly agree with your comments that we need you. The state needs you. My communities need you. The workforce gap in the future is the tsunami coming our way. So we need your success.
Thank you.
And I support that. So a couple comments. I was trying to gather my thoughts in the areas of efficiency, connectivity, being relevant, and being nimble. For efficiency, I think thank you today for pointing those things out, because clearly you're being efficient with the dollars you're given. I serve on the HHS committee, so my head swells with the requests for money, and it's a very hard process to decide where the state funds go. So we are obviously challenged as legislators to the taxpayers to make sure that money is being used efficiently. And your back room has done a lot of work in that area, so I commend you for that. In the area of connectivity, and Chancellor, you and I talked a little bit about this when we met. I think part of the challenge is in marketing. High school students are given a strong message about 4 years and getting a college degree, and I think we have a marketing challenge in our state to bring that back to the value of skills and trades and what really happens at our technical institutions. And that marketing challenge includes parents, and it includes teachers in our high school system. So I just encourage you, the more that you can reach out and get out, and if you want to come to any high schools in my community, tell them their legislator will accompany you, because it needs to be done. We need to get teachers into your facility so they can see the labs and they can feel the energy. In that same regard, too, in my community, we studied the percentage of kids that went on to four-year college, and we were upwards to, you know, above 80%. But then when we asked the question of how many of those students completed in 4 years and in 6 years, it was half. And so my question is, where are those students? Where are those 18 to 25-year-olds that do not have potentially, you know, a marketable skill and are already in debt? How do we get them into your system? How do we find them? And how do we reach the parents to encourage them, like the one student that was here today got encouraged by his parents to a very successful future? So that connectivity is big in my mind. The third one, relevancy. And just a challenge again. We have to connect industry to these in-demand fields. So the more that you can do to promote the relevancy of all of your programs is just going to be critical, and I guess critical to me as well as to where funding goes. The last one on being nimble or flexible, a challenge to staff flexibility. As you said, your students are 25 years old and plus, and they're working two-time jobs. So, you know, staff has to be flexible. Maybe it's Saturday classes. Maybe it's evening classes. Maybe it's online. I know you do a lot of that, but you're obviously going to have to do more, you know, to meet those student needs. Also, the challenge in, you mentioned losing students after a first year, and I totally get that. It's an interesting dynamic in an economy that is strong that your enrollment goes down.
Exactly.
Because the demand for workers is so great, and again, they get hired away. So I guess I challenge us as a board too, that is not a negative reflection. That's not people leaving because they're dropping out, some for finances, but they are being called away to work. So it's a good thing and a bad thing, because I see the enrollment decline. So we probably have to be creative in working with employers and manufacturers in promoting, work and education, a little bit of the German system in there. You know, how do we get that in Minnesota? Because so I see that nimble piece and how you staff and what you call a credit and a certificate is important. Lastly, my son is in a robotics program, so I'd really like your card. Okay. Okay, I'm very, very excited about that field. And I've taken kids on tours of manufacturing facilities. I started a robotics program at our high school. So congrats to you on what you're doing as well. And thank you all for being here to represent your institutions. Appreciate it. Like I said, I don't know if there was a question in there, but things to
sounded like a good testimonial or a little add-on to the testimony.
Extremely briefly, I just want to, Chair Norris, thank Representative Haley for the conversation we had last week, but also for these suggestions. I can assure you that President Duran will hear from me on the way home this evening, and she will take you up on this offer because you need to know how important she knows the college is to your community and the communities that are being served in that part of southeast Minnesota. I think many of the ideas you're sharing with us are things that are at various stages of gestation within our colleges and universities. This nimbleness, I think, is an absolutely essential point. We are doing all kinds of things differently than no one imagined 3 years ago, and it'll be even more different 3 years from now than any of us around this table can imagine. But I can assure you, and we had a study session between our board and all of our presidents on Tuesday morning, the energy there on our presidents talking about five different areas of innovation that they've been engaged in, along with some of the new work we're doing on marketing to tell the story, that's exactly the spirit of what we're doing. And your suggestions, I think, are right on the mark. And our hope is that over the months and years ahead, we can continue to share with us both our ideas, get your feedback, but share with you how we're trying to move forward on the thoughts you've had. So thank you.
Thank you for those comments. Appreciate it.
Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your presentation. And I'll echo some of the comments that have already been stated, that it's very thorough, and I appreciate all the information and work that was put into this. So thank you. Just a, kind of to echo Representative Haley, there is a challenge that we find with where to place funds, and HHS funding in particular is one of the fastest growing in the state. And so when you're when we're thinking about as legislators where to place money, it's not that we don't want to fund everything. It's just really it's impossible to fund everything everybody asks. So with that background, I did have an article here that I was just reviewing from NPR, and I just was wondering your thoughts on it. One of the recommendations that was in the article was regarding getting rid of two of the union, the faculty unions, and then based on the page G2 in the data book, which was interesting to me, that 75% of the fund expenditures are to faculty and staff for compensation, and that MMB negotiates one-third of those costs, and then they're under the employee unions, that their increases range from 2.7% to 6%, although the total revenue increases per year from state appropriations and tuitions was 2.3%. So the discrepancy there, would it be helpful in your estimation to look at those recommendations? And I know that you said you were going to, in the article it says there's going to be student and faculty input over the next couple of months. So given you a lot there, just wondering your thoughts or where you're at in that process.
Chair Normus, Representative Whalen, we're a long way away from that article, which probably ran last June, if I'm not mistaken. There is no proposal. There is no proposal to eliminate two faculty unions. The proposal that I brought to the board at the November board meeting is that we should enter into negotiations with our faculty unions to explore ways in which we can get greater flexibility in our faculty and our academic advisors working across multiple institutions. The solution here is not destroying faculty unions. The solution here is having an alignment between what our compensation costs are and what our new revenue is. As Vice Chancellor King suggested, many of our contracts are not negotiated by our Board of Trustees. They're negotiated by MMB. And so if MMB brings in a total compensation package that is above the 2.3% of our total new revenue over a period of years, we're handed that cost, but you all have left town and we're not provided the revenue to meet that cost. How do we deal with it? Our campuses make cuts in programs, in people, in advisors,
in technology and all the things we need to accomplish what it is we're trying to accomplish. If you look at that chart, you'll see that the faculty unions that our board does negotiate with came in substantially below the MMB compensation numbers. And if you look at the bottom of that chart, you'll see that the administrators came in the lowest of all.
Mm-hmm.
So our concern, and we'll talk more about this when we're together at our next hearing, is how do we ensure we get an alignment between what our costs are that are coming at us and what our revenues are? Because cutting is not a good way to build a future workforce for Minnesota. And that's the conundrum we're in. So we're not suggesting, again, underscored, bold, capital letters, not suggesting the elimination of two faculty unions. We are suggesting working collaboratively at the bargaining table with our unions to explore more flexible ways in which faculty can be used across multiple institutions. That's negotiation. And our conversation with you, and I will say we've had the conversation with MMB and the governor as well, we need to get an alignment between the resources we have and the costs, given that 75% of our entire budget are our people. Does that clarify?
Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that response. And if I can clarify, if I said proposal, I meant recommendations. There were recommendations provided to you by article, but I had said you were looking for input. And so I was seeking information on where you're at in that process, so that your response is very helpful. And I'd love to continue the conversation as we are moving along in this process. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Whalen, I appreciate that clarification. It was a lot of consultation since last June with our faculty and other bargaining units and our students and our presidents that led to, I think, a more constructive direction. So thank you.
We have time for just a couple more questions. Representative Pryor, next.
Thank you, Chair. And I recognize I could sit here all day asking questions because this is so interesting to learn and to know more about the system. One just general question is, it's the fourth largest system in the country, you started by saying. So is Minnesota unique in that we do combine state universities and two-year degree programs and technical colleges into one system? And does that seem to be a good model that other states should be following? Or are we just like this outlier that we do it our own way?
Chancellor.
Chair Nornes, I suspect more sharks here in the water. One way to answer the question is, as you probably know, Governor Dayton just recently appointed Roger Moe to our Board of Trustees, and he is, if you will, the godfather of this particular model. From my point of view, it does several things, which we're now finally achieving as a system. It produces huge efficiencies, as opposed to having three separate systems, three separate boards, three IT platforms, three payroll systems, three general counsel's office, and just everything else three times over. Secondly, we are now, with tremendous work being done by our faculty, producing seamless pathways for students to move from associate degrees to our universities in a way that being a unified system allows us to do. You may have read last fall that our seven state universities made the following promise. Any student who graduates with an associate's degree and completing the Minnesota transfer curriculum from any one of our colleges with a GPA of 2.0 or higher is guaranteed admission in any one of our universities. The only asterisk is Winona State University, Representative Pulaski, who has a standard of 2.4, not 2.0. That you get by playing as a system. The other thing that we've learned is that, unimagined when the system was created, we now have students that are attending multiple colleges and universities in the same semester, putting together courses where they can get them, where they fit in with their work schedule, where work is relative to where their homes are, and that's a tremendous opportunity to serve our students in ways that, quite frankly, probably wasn't imagined 20 years ago when the doors first opened. So I would argue that Minnesota is in a very lucky place. It is the only system in the country that's configured in this particular fashion, but it gives us some opportunities as a state that other systems, in my judgment, do not have.
Representative Pryor?
And I need your card, too. Okay.
All right. Representative Bernardi, you have the final. I'm not going to limit it to one question, but you are the last to ask questions.
Okay, so it is one question.
It might be a question, but one is a comment since Representative over there brought up her family history. That happens every committee, and I said I wasn't going to do it this year. But I do want to say last year was a momentous year for our family. We have two daughters went through, earned 3 degrees, two daughters total earned 3 degrees last year from Minnesota State, an Associate of Arts degree, a Bachelor's degree, and a Master's degree. And they all got jobs in their related field of study. So that's good, yeah.
That sounds like a mother speaking.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Spread their wings. But I am so glad that you shared that number because I've been trying to learn a little bit about this. I just talked to a Senator, Sandy Pappas, about this as well. But saying, did you say, I'd like you to clarify the number about $500 million if we were at the third, two-thirds funding. Right. Was that for Minnesota State itself? Can you just clarify that?
Certainly. Be happy to, Mr. Chair. Representative Bernardi, what we look at is if we assume the same mm-hmm. total amount of money and just change the mix,
mm-hmm.
We would have to add about $170 million a year for 2 years, which takes you out to nearly $500 million when you do the biennial math.
Okay.
And we would take out tuition dollars, and I'm not remembering the number. It's about $150 million, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd end up with the same amount of money at the other end of the equation, but we would have changed the green and red dollars by almost 50%, recognizing that we're at about 47% state support right now. So if we want to take that to 66%, that's an increase of almost 50% in funding levels.
Thank you, Mr. Bernardi. Chair. That is super helpful because I value that. I know it's in state statute that's our goal, or I can't remember how it's described. And I'd like us to work towards that because I feel like what's happened, and it's not just me feeling it, families have felt it, students have felt it. They've been working more jobs. Their families and students are getting in more debt. There was probably maybe less opportunities. I'm not sure at the colleges. I'm not sure about that. But when we do our state budget at the Capitol, we haven't been valuing what this brings to our state and the cost that this has placed and the burden that's been placed on our students, which is going to project itself into the future because they're not going to be able to buy their homes. Right. They're going to postpone their families. And we need to look at that, and I'm glad that you brought that up because I want to keep pursuing that, so thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. And I would also just commend for your attention a table in the data book that shows what our tuition and fees have been. Our board measures its affordability commitment as a percentage of median household income,
mm-hmm.
And we have maintained the same percentage relationship over the last 8 or 10 years. And we'll have, I think, another occasion to talk about this. But what's really changed in our students' life is their household income. And so that's what's explaining a lot of what's gone on with student debt.
Mm-hmm.
We would like to stay committed to this steady progress back toward the one-third, two-thirds. We started talking with you about it two biennia ago. And with your help and your contribution on the tuition side, we made progress this last time around. I'm particularly heartened because the conversation has shifted away from tuition freezes with no revenue replacement. That's a very damaging thing for our colleges and universities if we're simply told in session law not to raise tuition but not provided the revenue that tuition otherwise provides. And you see that illustrated in the graphic that the chancellor talked about. So we're heartened that this conversation is continuing and grateful for the support that we've had to date.
Thank you.
Thank you. I was going to raise the gavel, but we have one more question that popped up here. Representative Pawlowski.
Now, Mr. Chair, the statement made by Vice Chancellor King that there were tuition freezes without revenue, I disagree. We funded tuition freezes at the request that you gave us for tuition, Vice Chancellor King. And we had a discussion of this in 2013 and 14. And where you, I don't understand even again how you can say we did not tell you to freeze tuition without funding it. In fact, we put in record amounts. And you fought it. You fought it in 13 and you fought it in 14 and we won and the students won. and you lost.
Mr. Chair, I must have misspoke, because what I thought I was saying was that we're heartened that the conversation has shifted from tuition freezes without state support. We now have state support. That has been what's happened these last two biennia.
Mr. Chair,
helpful to our campus.
That was Wisconsin. I'm going to repeat, this is not Wisconsin. This is Minnesota. There was never discussion in this state to freeze tuition without funding it. So
that's
we're
exactly.
in
that's
Minnesota.
My point.
That's not what you said, Vice Chancellor King. Let's be accurate for once. And when we're accurate, I would hope we're accurate with record numbers of funding for higher education.
Amen.
But repeat, we're not Wisconsin.
Amen to that as well.
I want to say thank you to everybody that's here, of course, Chancellor and Ms. King and all the rest, and the special guests that you brought with you.
Thank you.
And those that just show up because it's a lot of fun. So, meeting is adjourned.